Chapter 25. Elisha, be thou glad of me. Grandcourt, having made up his mind to marry Miss Arleth, showed a power of adapting means to ends. During the next fortnight there was hardly a day on which by some arrangement or other he did not see her, or prove by emphatic attentions that she occupied his thoughts. His cousin, Mrs. Torrington, was now doing the honors of his house, so that Mrs. Davilow and Gwendolyn could be invited to a large party at Diplow in which there were many witnesses. How the host distinguished the dowerless beauty, and showed no solicitude about the heiress. The world, I mean Mr. Gaskin, and all the families worth speaking of within visiting distance of Pennicott felt an assurance on the subject which in the rector's mind converted itself into a resolution to do his duty by his niece, and see that the settlements were adequate. Indeed, the wonder to him and Mrs. Davilow was that the offer for which so many suitable occasions presented themselves had not been already made, and in this wonder Grandcourt himself was not without a share. When he had told his resolution to Lush, he had thought that the affair would be concluded more quickly, and to his own surprise he had repeatedly promised himself in a morning that he would today give Gwendolyn the opportunity of accepting him, and had found in the evening that the necessary formality was still unaccomplished. This remarkable fact served to heighten his determination on another day. He had never admitted to himself that Gwendolyn might refuse him, but heaven help us all, we are often unable to act on our certainties. Our objection to a contrary issue, were it possible, is so strong that it rises like a spectral illusion between us and our certainty. We are rationally sure that the blind worm cannot bite us mortally, but it would be so intolerable to be bitten, and the creature has a biting look we decline to handle it. He had asked leave to have a beautiful horse of his brought for Gwendolyn to ride. Mrs. Davilow was to accompany her in the carriage, and they were to go to Diplow to lunch, Grandcourt conducting them. It was a fine mid-harvest time, not too warm for a noonday ride of 5 miles to be delightful. The poppies glowed on the borders of the fields, there was enough breeze to move gently like a social spirit among the ears of uncut corn, and to wing the shadow of a cloud across the soft gray downs. Here the sheaves were standing, there the horses were straining their muscles under the last load from a wide space of stubble, but everywhere the green pasture made a broader setting for the corn fields, and the cattle took their rest under wide branches. The road lay through a bit of country, where the dairy farms looked much as they did in the days of our forefathers, where peace and permanence seemed to find a home away from the busy change that sent the railway train flying in the distance. But the spirit of peace and permanence did not penetrate poor Mrs. Davilow's mind so as to overcome her habit of uneasy foreboding. Gwendolyn and Grandcourt cantering in front of her, and then slackening their pace to a conversational walk till the carriage came up with them again, made a gratifying sight, but it served chiefly to keep up the conflict of hopes and fears about her daughter's lot. Here was an irresistible opportunity for a lover to speak and put an end to all uncertainties, and Mrs. Davilow could only hope with trembling that Gwendolyn's decision would be favorable. Certainly if Rex's love had been repugnant to her, Mr. Grandcourt had the advantage of being in complete contrast with Rex, and that he had produced some quite novel impression on her seemed evident in her marked abstinence from satirical observations, nay, her total silence about his characteristics, a silence which Mrs. Davilow did not dare to break. Is he a man she would be happy with? Was a question that inevitably arose in the mother's mind. Well, perhaps as happy as she would be with anyone else or as most other women are, was the answer with which she tried to quiet herself, for she could not imagine Gwendolyn under the influence of any feeling which would make her satisfied in what we traditionally call in circumstances. Grandcourt's own thought was looking in the same direction. He wanted to have done with the uncertainty that belonged to his not having spoken. as to any further uncertainty, well, it was something without any reasonable basis, some quality in the air which acted as an irritant to his wishes. Gwendolyn enjoyed the writing, but her pleasure did not break forth in girlish unpremeditated chat and laughter as it did on that morning with Rex. She spoke a little, and even laughed, but with a lightness, as of a far-off echo. For her too there was some peculiar quality in the air, not, she was sure, any subjugation of her will by Mr. Grandcourt, and the splendid prospects he meant to offer her. For Gwendolyn desired everyone, that dignified gentleman himself included, to understand that she was going to do just as she liked, and that they had better not calculate on her pleasing them. If she chose to take this husband, she would have him know that she was not going to renounce her freedom, or according to her favorite formula, not going to do as other women did. Grandcourt's speeches this morning were, as usual, all of that brief sort which never fails to make a conversational figure when the speaker is held important in his circle. Stopping so soon, they give signs of a suppressed and formidable ability so say more, and have also the meritorious quality of allowing lengthiness to others. How do you like Criterion's paces? He said, after they had entered the park, and were slacking from a canter to a walk. He is delightful to ride. I should like to have a leap with him, if it would not frighten Mama. There was a good wide channel we passed 5 minutes ago. I should like to have a gallop back and take it. Pray do. We can take it together. No, thanks. Mama is so timid, if she saw me, it might make her ill. Let me go and explain. Criterion would take it without fail. No, indeed, you are very kind, but it would alarm her too much. I dare take any leap when she is not by, but I do it, and don't tell her about it. We can let the carriage pass, and then set off. No, no, pray don't think of it anymore. I spoke quite randomly, said Gwendolyn. She began to feel a new objection to carrying out her own proposition. But Mrs. Davilow knows I shall take care of you. Yes, but she would think of you as having to take care of my broken neck. There was a considerable pause before Grandcourt said, looking toward her, I should like to have the right always to take care of you. Gwendolyn did not turn her eyes on him. It seemed to her a long while that she was first blushing, and then turning pale, but to Grandcourt's rate of judgment she answered soon enough, with the lightest flute tone and a careless movement of the head, oh, I am not sure that I want to be taken care of. If I chose to risk breaking my neck, I should like to be at liberty to do it. She checked her horse as she spoke, and turned in her saddle, looking toward the advancing carriage. Her eyes swept across Grandcourt as she made this movement, but there was no language in them to correct the carelessness of her reply. At that very moment she was aware that she was risking something, not her neck, but the possibility of finally checking Grandcourt's advances, and she did not feel contented with the possibility. Damn her, thought Grandcourt, as he too checked his horse. He was not a wordy thinker, and this explosive phrase stood for mixed impressions which eloquent interpreters might have expanded into some sentences full of an irritated sense that he was being mystified, and a determination that this girl should not make a fool of him. Did she want him to throw himself at her feet and declare that he was dying for her? It was not by that gate that she could enter on the privileges he could give her. Or did she expect him to write his proposals? Equally a delusion. He would not make his offer in any way that could place him definitely in the position of being rejected. But as to her accepting him, as he had done it already in accepting his marked attentions. And anything which happened to break them off would be understood to her disadvantage. She was merely coquetting, then. However, the carriage came up, and no further tete-a-tete could well occur before their arrival at the house, where there was abundant company, to whom Gwendolyn, clad in riding dress, with her hat laid aside, clad also in the repute of being chosen by Mr. Grandcourt, was naturally a center of observation, And since the objectionable Mr. Lush was not there to look at her, this stimulus of admiring attention heightened her spirits, and dispersed, for the time, the uneasy consciousness of divided impulses which threatened her with repentance of her own acts. Whether Grandcourt had been offended, or not, there was no judging. His manners were unchanged, but Gwendolyn's acuteness had not gone deeper than to discern that his manners were no clue for her, and because these were unchanged she was not the less afraid of him. As he had not been at Diplow before except to dine, and since certain points of view from the windows and the garden were worth showing, Lady Flora Hollis proposed after luncheon, when some of the guests had dispersed, and the sun was sloping toward 4 o'clock, that the remaining party should make a little exploration. Here came frequent opportunities, when Grandcourt might have retained Gwendolyn apart, and have spoken to her unheard. But no. He indeed spoke to no one else, but what he said was nothing more eager or intimate than it had been in their first interview. He looked at her not less than usual, and some of her defiant spirit having come back, she looked full at him in return, not caring, rather preferring, that his eyes had no expression in them. But at last it seemed as if he entertained some contrivance. After they had nearly made the tour of the grounds, the whole party stopped by the pool, to be amused with Fetch's accomplishment of bringing a water lily to the bank like Cooper's spaniel bow, and having been disappointed in his first attempt, insisted on his trying again. Here Grandcourt, who stood with Gwendolyn outside the group, turned deliberately, and fixing his eyes on a knoll planted with American shrubs, and having a winding path up it, said languidly, "This is a bore. Shall we go up there?" "Oh, certainly, since we are exploring," said Gwendolyn. She was rather pleased, and yet afraid. The path was too narrow for him to offer his arm, and they walked up in silence. When they were on the bit of platform at the summit, Grandcourt said, "There is nothing to be seen here. The thing was not worth climbing." How was it that Gwendolyn did not laugh? She was perfectly silent, holding up the folds of her robe like a statue, and giving a harder grasp to the handle of her whip, which as he had snatched up automatically with her hat, when they had first set off. "What sort of a place do you prefer?" said Grandcourt. "Different places are agreeable in their way. On the whole, I think, I prefer places that are open and cheerful. I am not fond of anything somber." "Your place of offending is too somber." "It is, rather." "You will not remain there long, I hope." "Oh, yes, I think so. Mama likes to be near her sister." Silence for a short space. "It is not to be supposed that you will always live there, though Mrs. Davilow may." "I don't know. We women can't go in search of adventures, to find out the Northwest Passage, or the source of the Nile, or to hunt tigers in the East. We must stay where we grow, or where the gardeners like to transplant us. We are brought up like the flowers, to look as pretty as we can, and be dull without complaining. That is my notion about the plants. They are often bored, and that is the reason why some of them have got poisonous. What do you think?" Gwendolyn had run on rather nervously, lightly whipping the rhododendron bush in front of her. "I quite agree. Most things are bores," said Grandcourt, his mind having been pushed into an easy current, away from its intended track. But, after a moment's pause, he continued in his broken, refined drawl, "But a woman can be married. Some women can. You, certainly, unless you are obstinately cruel." "I am not sure that I am not both cruel and obstinate." Here Gwendolyn suddenly turned her head and looked full at Grandcourt, whose eyes as he had felt to be upon her throughout their conversation. She was wondering what the effect of looking at him would be on herself, rather than on him. He stood perfectly still, half a yard or more away from her, and it flashed through her mind what a sort of lotus-eater stupor had begun in him, and was taking possession of her. Then he said, "Are you as uncertain about yourself as you make others about you?" "I am quite uncertain about myself. I don't know how uncertain others may be." "And you wish them to understand that you don't care? Said Grandcourt, with a touch of new hardness in his tone. I did not say that, Gwendolyn replied, hesitatingly, and turning her eyes away whipped the rhododendron bush again. She wished she were on horseback, that she might set off on a canter. It was impossible to set off running down the knoll. You do care, then, said Grandcourt, not more quickly, but with a softened drawl. Ha, my whip, said Gwendolyn, in a little scream of distress. As he had let it go what could be more natural in a slight agitation? And but this seemed less natural in a gold-handled whip which had been left altogether to itself. It had gone with some force over the immediate shrubs, and had lodged itself in the branches of an azalea halfway down the knoll. She could run down now, laughing prettily, and Grandcourt was obliged to follow. But she was beforehand with him in rescuing the whip, and continued on her way to the level ground, when she paused and looked at Grandcourt with an exasperating brightness in her glance and a heightened color, as if he had carried a triumph, and these indications were still noticeable to Mrs. Davilow, when Gwendolyn and Grandcourt joined the rest of the party. It is all coquetting, thought Grandcourt. The next time I beckon she will come down. It seemed to him likely that this final beckoning might happen the very next day, when there was to be a picnic archery meeting in Cardle Chase, according to the plan projected on the evening of the ball. Even in Gwendolyn's mind, that result was one of two likelihoods that presented themselves alternately, one of two decisions toward which she was being precipitated, as if they were two sides of a boundary line, and she did not know on which she should fall. This objection to a possible self, a self not to be absolutely predicted about, caused her some astonishment and terror. Her favorite key of life doing as she liked seemed to fail her, and she could not foresee what at a given moment she might like to do. The prospect of marrying Grandcourt really seemed more attractive to her than as he had believed beforehand that any marriage could be. The dignities, the luxuries, the power of doing a great deal of what she liked to do, which had now come close to her, and within her choice to secure or to lose, took hold of her nature, as if it had been the strong odor of what he had only imagined and longed for before. And Grandcourt himself? He seemed as little of a flaw in his fortunes as a lover and husband could possibly be. Gwendolyn wished to mount the chariot, and drive the plunging horses herself, with a spouse by her side who would fold his arms, and give her his countenance without looking ridiculous. Certainly. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.